Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The normal format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight, we have a special meeting where we get to have a speaker, Debbie S. from Richmond. And at this time, I'm going to welcome her up.
Hello, everyone. I'm Debbie Sangster, and I am an alcoholic. Before I do all my statistics, I just want to say how humbled and grateful I am to be here. Thank you, Dave. He's one of my favorite people than Morgan. And this is great home group. Been here before. Me, my husband, and my son, we're all members of AA, and I've been here through the years when you're at the other church. And so I was really honored. And he knows me, so he knows what he's getting into when he asked me to speak. But anyway, I've been sober since May 30th, 2006. And I am truly grateful. And every time I say that, I just want to cry. I'm so grateful. Because I thought I was too smart. It doesn't take me out at all. So I'm very grateful to be here. I have a sponsor. Dave knows her. Christy, she's the sunshine of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm quite different from her. I picked her, I think, because she's so positive and I'm kind of dark and, you know, a little crazy sometimes, and she balances that out and helps. She's a wonderful member of Alcoholics. So I'm, you know, sponsored by her. We've been together 17. She's a great lady. And I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring one of the special gals here tonight, and very grateful for people that want to walk this path with me. And I need them because I want to live. And it tells us, you know, you don't give this way. You know, self-sacrifice and work for others, you're going to make it, and I'm going to make it. So, and it is self-sacrifice sometimes, but anyway, it's worth it. Anyway, let's see. My story is, it's hard to tell, man. You know, if you picked up one chip, just stay here. It's a lot easier if you say, you know, you stay sober and you're asked to speak. I was in and out for 10 years, and it's like what it was like and what happened. What it was like and what happened. What it was like and what happened. What it was like and then what happened. I spoke last Wednesday at my home group, actually, and I could only make it through 2 of 5 or 6 psych wards I was in. And so anyway, it's just really different. But anyway, so we'll see, because I prayed and I asked for the power that God of my understanding. Because there's somebody that needs what I have to say. There might be someone that will identify with me. If you identify with me, you are in the right place. So please stay. But anyway, I grew up in Kentucky. So that's where I have a little bit of a twang here. And I grew up in an alcoholic household. And the youngest of 3 girls. That doesn't make me alcoholic, but it certainly added some, trauma being one. But my dad was a blackout vodka drinker, and he was a bowler maker. He was a blue collar worker, and he would get off work on Friday night, and my mom would pile us kids up in the car, and we'd go out looking for him, and she'd find him, and we'd get home, and it was all hell. It was shotguns and fists and all kinds of stuff. So as a result, I had a little issue that started when I was about 10 of panic attacks. And anyway, so it would seem normal to me. And so that doesn't make me alcoholic. But what happened is my alcoholism hid behind a mental illness. And that's what almost killed me. So when I was 13, I had my first drink. And this is just crazy. But my dad bought me the alcohol. And I thought I needed this alcohol because I was 13 and I was going to a teen party, and I was about as tall as I am now and like this thin. And I guess I was interested in boys. My sisters were a little bit older, and I don't know how my 13-year-old brain knew that I needed alcohol But it did. So I asked my dad to buy me some. He bought me a pint of bourbon. Live in Kentucky, so everybody drinks bourbon. And now this seems normal to me because, you know, I'm in an alcoholic household. Until I got sober and I had a child, I'm like, oh my God, my dad bought me alcohol when I was 13. But the very first time I drank, I blacked out. And for me, I believe I don't have an on and off switch. You know, it's like, I don't know when to quit. And I evidently didn't know the first time. So I drank the rooms, you know, and so I didn't like, it's like, oh my God, I want to do that again. I feel that God shaped whole with a lot of other things. I always felt a little less than or whatever. And I did, like, let me just give you an example of my dad. So, you know, when you live in an alcoholic home, there's a lot of secrets, but I think I was in high school and I had decided, you know, like, oh, cheerleaders are popular. So I'm going to be a cheerleader. And I was a swimmer and I ran track and I was the president of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And I kind of was straight edge because that I was seeking comfort. I was seeking somewhere to fit, you know, and on paper that looks good. But as I've grown in my, you know, recovery and see, I've always been trying to do something to make myself feel better and to feel that God-shaped hole. So that's what was on tap at that time. So that kept me from drinking and stuff, you know, but anyway, so I had some friends come over and I was in high school and they were from the nicer part of town and all that. And they came over to see me with their boyfriend. They bought him from college. We had just graduated high school. It was the first year of college. My dad shows up at the door with a wife beater on and a t-shirt and cut off shorts with his stuff hanging out, smoking a joint. So anyway, yeah, that was, you know, normal at my house. Very embarrassing. But anyway, I, you know, after high school and all that, I lived in this little small town, Owensboro, Kentucky, and I moved to Lexington, Kentucky. A lot of the gals I'd gone to high school with had gone to UK there, and I just wanted to get out of that small town, and, you know, I was like 19, 20, but I'd start partying and drinking and going to bars and smoke a little weed, but alcohol was my thing, man. I love drink. And moved to Lexington, met a guy there, and moved to Richmond. So I moved to Richmond. And he was my first husband. And so we just partied, you know, got here in Richmond. It was the early 80s. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of that story with Bill, you know, he had arrived, you know, he was having fun and drinking and everything's good. And that's what it felt like for me. And I had a group of people we ran with and everybody drank. And what's going on behind the scenes is I start having these horrible, severe panic attacks where I'm rushed to the emergency room thinking I'm dying. I remember one was when I was 16, and that's before I didn't smoke. I didn't drink then. I was a competitive swimmer. I was an athlete, tip-top shape. And one day my sister had to rush me to the emergency room because I felt like I couldn't breathe and I was dying. And the doctor was like, you're might be the healthiest person I've ever seen, and there's nothing wrong with you. And so that kept going on. So through the years after that happened several times, they put me on some stuff and, you know, and I just took that and continued drink and going with my life. That's supposed to help you with anxiety. And that's for, it's supposed to be for short term, but anyway, so, but my big thing was drinking. So as a result of this, you know, panic all the time, you develop this anxiety. And the only time I really felt good was drinking. I love drinking. I love everything about drinking. And I got away with it, you know, without a lot of consequences, lost some jobs, all that. They don't like it when you show up like reeking of alcohol and hungover and everything. So that just got another job. Hell, it's kind of like for me, it's my drinking career. And if you say you have a drinking career, then you're probably an alcoholic. We're the only ones that have a career in alcoholism. So it's like drinking and fun. Yay. And then going for a period of time, then drinking with problems. But because what alcohol does for me, I can deal with some problems. I'm good at talking my way out of things or skirting around things, or I'll deal with a little losing a job. I'll get another one. And then for me, then it's all problems and no fun. That's where mine always ends up. But anyway, so I, you know, have this going on. I'm in Richmond and we get married. And then in 1986, I was coming home from a party and I got pulled over and got a DUI. And at that time, they didn't make you go to AA meetings, which I think they do now because we have to sign a lot of slips and all that kind of stuff. But they did send me to ASAP. I don't know if y'all have that around here. Yeah. So anyway,
yes, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's right. It's yeah. So I had to go to that three times a week. And they said, you can't drink. I'm like, not problem. I'm not an alcoholic. And I know there was another girl in there in this class with me. I was like, my God, they're trying to make us think we're alcoholics. I'm not one of them. And so, but that was the first time I had to look at my drinking because I was like, no problem. But it was a problem. I needed a drink, but I didn't know I needed to. And so I thought, well, I just drink on the days I go to class, you know. So I made it through that, went on with my life. And you know, and just proceeded to drink, party, and end up in psych wards, you know, for my panic attacks and all that. Well, no, I wasn't in psych wards. I just went to doctors and then they give you pills. So, so my husband and I, got separated. I don't think we're divorced yet, but at the time I was working for, corporate America, working for AT&T and down in Richmond in sales and marketing. And man, it was the best job for a budding alcoholic, or I was already alcoholic by then. I just didn't know it. But lots of drinking and partying, and it was very acceptable to drink at lunch. And, you know, and even the, you know, like the boss's boss, he would take us, we went to this little place called Penny Lane Pub in Richmond, and we'd eat lunch there and have a few drinks. Sometimes we just stay there and not even go back to work, you know. I mean, so, and my husband, who worked for AT&T, he was in public relations. He had like a bar, he always had a bar in his office the entire time he worked. But anyway, I had to walk to the damn restaurant to get a drink, you know. But anyway, how my alcoholism also shows up is, you know, my sponsor gave me the words for this, and it's so true, this God-shaped, like I always feel like there's something I need that I don't have just to make me okay. Because, you know, for me, this is an inside job. I can present to the world what I want you to see, but I got this whole other dialogue going on in here, like, oh, what's she doing that? You know, just on and on and on. It's exhausting, but it's gotten better. But husband number one wasn't working out, so I knew that I needed me another man. Well, I think I just wanted to get rid of men entirely because I'd started building my career, and believe it or not, there's some jobs you could actually, you know, like continue to go up the ladder of success and make money when you're drinking. And sales and marketing, I'm still in sales, and too long I'm ready to retire, but I was good at what I did and it didn't interfere with that. But I, you know, decided to get rid of him and move on. But in the meantime, I saw that silver fox back there, my husband, my current husband, and we were at the Penny Lane Pub, and I'm just like, woe is me, something. And he walks in, I'm like, now if I had him, I know I'd be okay. And we had one few small issues. He was still married and had a 6-month-old baby. So that, like I said, I'm good at sales. Very persuasive. Yeah, that was fun immense, let me tell you. But anyway, so we ended up together. We actually were good friends, and all of a sudden we're together, and it was wonderful. He likes to drink like I do, and not a lot of me, but he and I could drink and buddies, and you know, and he's a so we got together, life is good. We continue drinking. I've got someone I'm drinking with that's not questioning my drinks, even better. And again, my God-shaped tool inside is, what else do I need? Well, I need a baby because my biological ticking. That's what's wrong. I need a baby. So I, our son was alcoholic because all I ever wanted. And, but what happened is, and so my drinking, please believe me, it's going, I mean, it's, lunch was very acceptable until I had to start drinking first thing in the morning during the week. I mean, on the weekends we did that, but I had to have a drink to even function. But I kept getting, after we had our son in 1994, my drinking really changed. And thank God I was able to not drink when I was pregnant with him, because I had this morning sickness thing the whole time. And I mean, I wanted to drink, but the smell, I mean, I was literally sick the entire time I was pregnant. But the minute I had that baby, I got it on. But what started happening, it became very unpredictable. I could have like two glasses of wine and like black out, or I could like have 10 and not get a buzz, you know? And so I started getting really horrible depressions and anxiety. And so I started going to my doctor and he's like, maybe it's delayed postpartum depression. Here, take this. I'm like, okay. And then, you know, I'm getting worse, not better. And so they send me to the panic anxiety specialty. And so they start treating me. And it's really helpful if you tell them that you're drinking all day long. But I didn't, because in my mind, and this is where the mental illness part of that, because I did have trauma. A lot of things happened in my household that no child should ever see. I didn't know that, you know, and other things, you know, but I thought that if they could just give me the right pill combination and the right talk therapy, that I could go back to normal drinking, which is at lunchtime. And I mean, this seriously. And so they're throwing all this stuff at me, really trying to help me. And you know, and then that, you know, they're like, well, you know, we're going to put you on these. And so, you know, there was a lot of, and please believe me when I say I respect and admire and love the medical community that works so hard to help support us, you know, and I'm not putting down, I think everyone should, you know, get help for any of their mental health issues and do what is prescribed, but it helps if you're telling the truth, and I wasn't telling the truth. So what I was doing was very dangerous because I was on loaded up on benzos and booze. And so, and a bunch of other pills. I read Dave the list. I didn't know what they were, but anyway, they kept me in like la la land for a long time. So I'm on all these pills and nothing's working. And, you know, I have started drinking in the morning, and how I like to drink is vodka with a little splash of orange juice and a big coffee cup just to, you know, get my feet and get the whip, you know, because I wake up with an impending sense of doom. What did I do? Where did I put my child? Do I have a child? Yes, I think I have a baby. Where is it? You know, and all I ever wanted was to be a mom and love that child. And I had a lot of stuff that I mean, on paper, I had a beautiful home, good looking husband, a beautiful baby, a good job, good car, you know, I'm dying inside and drinking myself to death. And, you know, like going out in public, like, oh yeah, okay. Well, I stopped going out in public because, you know, well, people think you can't smell vodka, but you can. You know, I just need to drink. And I like to drink and think about what I'm going to do about my drinking problem, though it's not a drinking problem. And so I would get up in the morning to have my vodka and kind of catch my breath and figure out what I'm going to do. And then I'd have like about a 12 pack of beer. Now, Bob, I'm working from home at that time, and I still work from home in sales and marketing. They threw you at home when they wanted to save office space. That worked well for me. And he would go into the office and I'd drink a 6 or 12 pack. And what I would do, I'd have to run to the store to replace it. And sometimes I'd get the wrong one. And he knew I was drinking it all, but I lied and said I wasn't. And then I had a big old bottle of Marcus James Chardonnay. So when he got home from work, he had a big old stadium cup full of vodka with one olive. That was his martini. And I'm talking, Bob's known for his stadium cups, those big, huge, like big gulp cups. And I'd take a few sips of that, drink a whole big thing of Marcus James Chardonnay, maybe have a little red wine. And then when you drink all day, your mouth gets puckery, you know, it's like, so I drink apricot brandy that smoothed it all out. And then I'm popping benzos all day and taking all kinds of other pills. So I'm just, everything's great. But what happened was, you know, like, it's okay if I'm bothering you about my drinking, but when I start scaring myself, and I started scaring myself, I was like, what the hell's going on? So one day I decided in August of 1996, I think I have to laugh. Like, I told you how I drink, and I'm always pondering what's wrong with me. And I was like, I might have a drinking problem. Newsflash, you know. And I mean, that shows you the denial and delusion, huh? You know, I mean, that's why I have to laugh. Like, clearly there was a problem, but I thought it was a psychiatric man. They were going to fix it with these pills. And so anyway, I decided I wasn't going to drink. and I was going to get myself together. And so we had like secretarial support, and I could go like a drop-in office over at AT&T, and I was going to start going over there so I wouldn't drink. And I tried to do that, and I was like a dog chasing its tail. I could not think. I had to have alcohol to function. I could not like even shower. I looked in the mirror and I saw myself for the first time. I was bloated and red faced, and my eyes, they saw that picture too. My eyes were like this, and I thought they were wide open. And so my solution to that is, and this is how it was for me, I'm going to think about my drinking problem tomorrow. I'm going to do something about it. But right now I need a drink. I just was, you know, so I decided I need my own bottle of vodka. So Bob wouldn't realize how much vodka I was drinking. So I think I went up to ABC, got my own vodka, started drinking it. And for the first time, and here it was, I could not get that sense of ease and comfort that I live for, man. You know, that's my favorite place in the book. And the doctors, of course, I am restless, irritable, and discontent, and depressed, and anxious, and hating, and cussing, and in a fetal position. But I get some booze in me, and I can think. And I have plan B, plan C, plan D. Have you ever done it when you're like, okay, it's like, oh, yeah, that liquid courage? Didn't get that day. I fixed a spicy Bloody Mary. I fixed every drink that always lifted me up. And I ended up going crazy. And somehow I was supposed to be taking care of our 2-year-old son. And Bob's out at a customer event for AT&T. And then getting his mom on the phone, who was like a teetotaler Southern Baptist woman, you know. And she took me to Tucker's, which is our local psych ward. They kept me for 10 days. And I think I ended up there because I was going to Tucker's psychiatric, and I'm like, ah, and they sent me to Tucker's, and I'm just heaving and crying. And when you talk to other, it's not a good idea to talk to other drinking, like your drinking buddies, about your drinking problem, because they'll give you some really good excuses for why you're drinking that way. And I talked to my alcoholic family, and they're like, well, you're just having early menopause. I'm like, I'm 36. I don't think it's just don't drink so much, or, you know, you'll be okay. Just drink a couple of beers. And so anyway, this is the one, because my mom's like, you might be having a nervous breakdown like your granny did. And so I go there thinking I'm having a nervous breakdown, and they're going to fix it. They're going to give me the real pill that's going to fix this. And so I said, what's wrong with me? They're like, you're an alcoholic. And I mean, it snapped. I said, no, I'm not. I'm an account executive with AT&T. Let's put her in the special ward. I mean, how crazy is that? I'm so glad I called. So anyway, they're like, They kept me for 10 days. I mean, they kind of spin you and throw you out, but I was in bad shape. And they're like, you are lucky to be alive. Benzos and booze can kill you. So everybody listen, benzos and booze can kill you. The combination, and probably a lot of you know that, but if you don't, I didn't know. And also you have to be medically off that stuff. So I've been on it for years. So I went in, and that's where so they told me that, and I don't know, then they give you your phenobarbital. It's like, okay, where do I go? And you know, it's on. And so anyway, they were having an AA meeting. Well, I knew AA wasn't good because my dad, who was an alcoholic, went, and he said they were a bunch of people trying to get up and open. I'm like, okay, well, anybody have my business. And my mom didn't have good things to say about it. And not that, it is funny when people come in and their life is down here. Like, nobody wants to get in your business. I promise you. I mean, nobody wants any of that, you know. I mean, obsession with self. I mean, I'm down in the gutter and Tucker's like, thinking about me. No, they're not. But I mean, I just have to, I'm so glad I could laugh about this stuff, you know, because it's funny. It wasn't funny at the time. But anyway, so I was like, well, you know, in the psych ward, you don't have a full social calendar. So I thought, you know, maybe I could help those people. And I've seen plenty of people like, I want to get sober first if you want to help alcohol, you know. So anyway, so I went to the meeting. I was like, it's going to be a bunch of old men. And it was, but it was, I'll never forget the guy's name. I know his name is Sam Black. And he came up there to that psych ward. And that's where I go now. I love psych wards. I love them. They started talking about the language of the heart. You know, I was like, you know, this inside thing that's going on, the pills aren't working, what's wrong, and I can't be alcoholic. Look at me. I got a house. I have a car. I have a husband. You know, I didn't know an alcoholic. And I just felt like I was just crazy. I mean, it was scary in my head. And they started putting labels to my crazy that helped me to say, you know, they talked about, because what shame and guilt does a woman have that as a mother, you know? And you love your child and you want, or father, you know, we love our kids. And you know, and I'm driving around high and drunk all the time and can't remember if I brought them home with me, or if they're in bed, or, you know, endangering their life. And you know, I remember just standing over Rice's crib and going, like, wrong with you, this precious thing, this precious gift, this child, and look what you're doing. So they start talking about that stuff. That it doesn't matter. Love cannot conquer alcoholism. Doesn't matter how much you love somebody or don't want to hurt somebody. I am powerless. I have lost power. You know, doesn't matter how much somebody loves me or I love them or whatever. If I have this thing, it demands treatment, or it will take me out. But before that, it's going to destroy and remove and terrify the people that love you the most. And I know that because my son's 10 and a half years sober, and I've gotten to hear his story and the effect I had on him. First time I heard it, I was like, thank God I get to hear the terror and fear I instilled in my child when I started drinking again after 6. So when I better get sober for the first time here, because you know, I relapsed after 6 years. That's a whole, but anyway, so no, God's in charge. So what's coming out is what's supposed to come out. So anyway, but you know, thank God. So anybody that goes to those places, psych wards or hospitals or whatever, you never know how you might help, because I had nothing, you know. But when, how much you love, oh my God. So what it did is sold on, I'm going to go see people. They're nice. And I had pretty much isolated myself because I drank so much. I couldn't be around nice people, you know, and I'm high and drunk and, you know, so I got out there and I was scared, you know, and fear might get me to the meeting, but fear won't keep me here if I don't, you know, get involved in this deal. So I went to the meetings and hung around AA, you know, I got a sponsor and pretty much did what she asked me. But what happened to me, that was before Val, Sammy, or Christy. I now have, I've had these three women. I call them the Holy Trinity. They're three women. They've all been my sponsor, but this was one of their sponsees. They had to, like, Sammy had to push her out of the way and come deal with me, because I'm a lot. I mean, I'm a lot of crazy. I got a strong personality and I'm smarter than you. And they showed me I wasn't. But anyway, so this gal was a little too nice. And I want you to know, like, okay. So finally I start feeling better and I'm working better. And then I've gone off to church because I'm gonna get religious. I got a new hairdo and I'm gonna do all this stuff, you know. To fix me. And then AA in this. And I remember, you know, I just wanted to yak and talk and not listen, you know. And then I started getting really busy because I'm now a church lady and trying to be a mom and doing all this stuff. And so I would go to the meeting. I did have a home group, but I would go about 10 minutes after, because they read that same stuff every time and I'd already memorized it. They must be stupid. They have to hear it every time, but I've already got it memorized. I tell you, this is what you're dealing with. And so my sponsor, you know, comes, you need to keep this early. I said, you're lucky I'm here. I'm busy. And so anyway, I came around. And, oh, then what I would do is one of those people that would come in 10 minutes late, not sure what the topic is, but God, I'm going to share with you, you know. So I love those people. They're so, you know. And yeah, sometimes I kind of cringe, like, oh my God, but no, I can laugh today. It's all good. But I was just talking to, Elizabeth. We were talking about the generosity and love and support in AA when we're in and out and showing up. They always take you, like, come on in, you know, nobody else is glad to see you, but these people seem to be. And, it's true. I mean, this is the only place in the world, you know, it's like, oh, there, he's over there drunk. I'm like, oh, you precious. And all the guys go over there and get their numbers. And, but, Oh, I lost my train of thought there. Let's see here. So I'd go into meetings and then she's telling me I need to be there more and early and do this and do that. And then I was like, no, it all I wanted to do was complain about my husband all the time. And they're like, well, finally, well, no, I can't do that. And he was still drinking. And so finally it just, I was like, you know, I've had enough of this. And I went and got me some wine and drank. He came home from work and I made us some cocktails. He said, I didn't think you're supposed to drink. I said, I've learned everything I need to learn there. Those classes are done, you know. He said, oh, okay, good. Because he was having to kind of curtail his drinking a little bit. So we drank and I think he passed out. Then I got on the phone, started calling every damn person I know. I was drunk dialing and crazy and a loon. And then that lasted for 11 months. And guess what? You know, my experience proves I'm an alcoholic. Because did it get better? No. It gets worse, never better. And it got worse. So I continued just drinking around the clock. Just out of my mind. I mean, I don't know how my son made it through life. I mean, well, Bob was drinking, but he was one of those guys that could drink and pass out every night and get up like at 5 a.m. and empty the trash and all that. And I'm like in a fetal position and like, let me get some vodka so I can get going here, you know, do anything. Pop my claw up and let's go. But that stopped working, man. So by November the 13th of 1998, I woke up that morning because I had over one of my girlfriends. This is before cell phones. It was on a house phone. I was in the basement and he was upstairs. Heard the phone ring and I picked the phone up and I could hear him talking to my friend. And he said, I don't know what to do. She's drinking herself to death. And this is a man that drinks like massive cups of vodka and scotch every night. So I'm like, but something stopped me in my tracks. And I was like, he's right. Because I'd been around long enough to know, and a couple people that I had been in Tucker's with that time, 10 days, I'd already gone to their funeral. And they weren't shooting dope and stuff. They were drinking. And one, it was a young guy, he had esophageal hemorrhage. And I got scared again. So I called Val. These people always seem so nice when you're new, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, call me, I'll help you. I don't know if she's my best friend in the entire world. I love her so much. And she's been sober 30 something years. And so I called her, she came to my house to 12 step me. And, you know, and I went, she gave me, and she's like 6 foot tall, blonde, just strong woman. And man, that's exactly what my, because I will bulldoze people. I mean, you know, and I was kind of scared of her. And she got me centered. She showed me what it means to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's like just not drinking, going to meetings, like give me a pistol now. I've been trying to not drink and it's not working. But being in the middle of the circle and the triangle, locked and loaded. And that's what my current sponsor, and then when Sammy was my sponsor, they're all women. And that's how I sponsor my gals. And, you know, is we're going to get you in all three sides. You got to be locked and loaded to even have a chance. And I tell you, God, the other thing I have done really right is I have continued to persistently take care of my recovery and show up. I've made all kinds of mistakes. I've been annoying or whatever, but I stay in this circle and triangle. So she showed me that. We went through the steps, you know, got in a home group, learned what it's like to be a home group member. You show up early. You know, I know I'm talking to a room of people that know all that stuff. I didn't know. It's like, I thought I was supposed to come up and throw my problems on the floor. Like, no, nobody wants your crap. Just shut up and work this out. You have nothing. Nobody has anything you want. And I needed to hear that. You know, it was like, we share our experience, strength, and hope. But what my sponsor did do was got me immediately into action. I mean, I'm a week or two sober and going to jails and picking up women and pick them up from crack houses and doing this. I mean, I would cry like, oh my God, this is scary. That's going to be you if you don't. So, just drink and sit down. And I drank the Kool-Aid. I got involved. And I liked it, you know, and then my husband and I still, everything, my drinks that got me help. Yep. I need, and then my recovery. But when you I am a recovered people pleaser. I mean, I tell you, I am. It's almost gone too far to the other side. But anyway, that's all right. I can't be tough. But when I say what I mean what I say. And I just, but I used to be like, oh, yeah. What started happening with me is about 3.5 years after I've gone through, you know, all the steps, and I'm living in 10, 11, and 12, and I'm speaking, and I'm sponsoring, and I'm taking a turkey to the Alcathon, I start getting really sick. And again, this, I have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and I need adult supervision, and I need to tell you what I'm really thinking, feeling, believing, and what I'm really doing. But I would tell the politically correct thing. Oh, yeah, because I started feeling this, I know what it is now. It's a spiritual malady of alcoholism, you know, and it's just tight and tight. And I'm like, oh, yeah, he's great. And then my sponsor would say something to me, you know, for us to drink is to die. And I'd be like, oh, yeah. And in my mind, I'm having a whole other dialogue. Maybe you, but I'm a little smarter than that. That's not happening to me. I would take everything that people said to me and turn it into my own version to apply to me, you know. And so I wasn't being honest. And, you know, in how it works, that first paragraph, it mentions honesty 3 times. And I didn't realize that till I relapsed after 6 years and made it back. I'm like, they're not kidding. And I realized that had I, you know, so what is going on inside of me is I'm getting anxious. I'm getting depressed. I think I'd gotten off. Yeah, I was benzo free, you know, but I couldn't tell anybody because I've got a front and I'm sponsoring people now. You can't know I'm not doing well. I mean, what are they going to think, you know? And so I'm fronting. And then I start thinking that AA works good for not drinking, but there is something else wrong with me. And today I know what it is. Thank God. But then I didn't. So I ended up at like 5 years. So, well, let's see. I think I got the. I remember Val was trying to talk some sense into me, and I decided that I needed to be on benzos again because I have, you know, I'm just wired this way, and I've got these panic attacks. And she said, "You're going to drink. If you take those, you're going to drink." And I'm like, screw you. And I fired her and got another sponsor and did. And so there's like a whole year before I even picked up a drink. I don't remember, but I was really sick and I started backing away from AA. It wasn't a conscious thing. And my husband was sober and going to AA and he kept throwing the life preserver. But I ended up, I remember my 6 years, I picked up a chip and I remember thinking, I got this. 3 days later, I'm drunk, and it just happened like that because my relapse started at 3.5 years when I started the dishonesty about not telling you what's really going on, what I'm thinking and my fears and you know, what I'm thinking about AA. And so I ended up drinking and I went to a level of insanity. Like that's why I think tonight might be the first time I've been able to see my sobriety date from the podium without crying because I've seen so many people die. And we've lost so many people and people I sponsor that didn't drink and do some of the stuff I did. So I just feel really lucky, but I got to a point of pure insanity. And Bob was out of the country at the time. My son, our son Rice, I guess he was about 10 because 17, yeah, maybe 10. He had never really seen me drink. And then I tell him, he saw booze in the fridge. I said, I'm holding that for somebody's mother. I'm taking it to her. And then, you know, at first he liked it. He was like, you know, a little skateboarder and started, you know, sneaking cigarettes. And all the kids in the neighborhood, their parents would show up. I'm passed out on the couch. I mean, I don't even know what's up. But somehow Bob came back. They pulled me out of the house, got me in St. Mary's again. And that was my second or third time there. Yeah, 5 years sober. I don't know if I finished that sentence. I was in the psych ward. And anyway, I thank God that saved my life. I remember these ladies that came to help me. They were church ladies. They were nice. We went to this through Bonnier Baptist. It was called Celebrate Recovery. And we had been engaged in that. And they heard I was drinking. And they had recently had lost another woman that was my age. And our children are the same age from drinking. And they came over to my house and they said they came and got Rice and took him to their home. And then they said they were going to come take me to the hospital. I said, I don't know if it's that bad. I, you know, maybe I could just go to a meeting. And they said, well, we're going to come anyway. And I said, well, can you bring me something to drink if I'm going to rehab? And they said, yeah, we'll bring you a beer. I'm like, you don't understand. I need a 12 pack of whatever. So they bought that. And I remember moved to go to the hospital. If I hadn't, I'd be dead. I mean, I was that delusional. So I went to the hospital for another 10 days and went away to rehab. That was November. That was in 2005, I think was that. And anyway, I came back, drank again, because I was mad at everybody in AA. I only wanted to go to certain meetings because people were probably thinking and talking about me, and they weren't. They were happy to see me. They're glad I didn't die, you know? And so I ended up drinking again that night. I got so awful. I can't remember much about it, but Rice does. He called somebody in AA to come get him, and I was home by myself, and I wanted to kill myself. And I even got a knife and looked, and I'm like, I know my luck. I'll do that. Blood will get all over the place. They'll put me in the bad side of the psych ward, and I won't be able to smoke. So I just laid there, you know. And I called my sponsor the next morning, Christy, who was my sponsor at the time. And I said, I drank again. She said, and this was my, Elizabeth, we were talking about psychic awakening, spiritual awakenings. And this was mine. She said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. And that was a psychic change for me, because I always have a plan. I'm going to do this. I'm smarter than her. I don't need to do that. I want the shortcut. I'm going to be happy, joyous, and free at day 30 because I'm smart like that. But anyway, elimination of my drinking is but a beginning, but not even the tip of the eye, the tip, because of the spiritual malady, because of the thing I have going on. And these are the things I learned. I thank God made it back. And how I showed up was I hated AA. I hated everybody in AA other than Christy, because she's really nice. And maybe one other person. And I hated God because I went to their church. First, I did my Catholic thing because I was born and raised Catholic. Then I went to the Baptist, and they all suck because none of that worked. Joyce Myers and all them, they can go to hell. And I'd done all their little things. And, you know, the pills didn't work, nothing worked. And I felt hopeless. And so what I did, you know, when I called Christy for help, she said, come to the meeting, pick my white chip. And I made a decision that even though I don't think this is going to work, because I've done it for God's sake, I could recite the big book, that the other thing gave me hope was seeing the people that had stayed, like Dave, Christy, Valerie, you know, all the people, the years I've been in and out, they were still there. Their life was going a lot better than mine. And I believe they believed. So I was willing to take the action and follow the directions of the Black Print, not my version of it. And I'm like, I'll give it a year. And if not, I'll go drink or kill myself or something. Meantime, I'll change my will, because I hated my husband at the time too. And he ain't getting none of my 401k, which I don't even know if I still had any, but and I was gonna write a letter to my son. And you know, so anyway, minute by minute, day by day, month by month, and now I can't believe that. Well, I mean, I'm like, and that's not very long. I'm just a beginner. I really am. There's work to be done. And, but I'm okay just as where I am, who I am. I'm cool with that because I know this program works. And, so, you know, man, if I was poofed perfect, you know, I'd never get well by how fabulous you are. I get well by hearing your struggles and your hope. That's why I love Dave's story. We have him down to Richmond twice in a month, the back to back. Cause you know, he was a pretty hopeless guy too. But you know, we just show, you know, it's so what happened as a result of that. And I tell you, another person had a huge influence on my recovery was Don Major and Bob Darrell. They came and did their circuit speakers, and they did a thing in 2007, Living Sober. And they used to come every May and every January. And John Major would always say, it doesn't matter what you think, feel, or believe. It matters what you do. What actions am I taking? If I base it on how I'm feeling, I ain't going to do it. And that's what used to happen to me. Some things are coming to me, and it's usually at the end when it's time for me to stop. I would always, like, if I'm depressed, like, that's one of the reasons I end up relapsing after rehab and, you know, that little period of time I had, because I was depressed. So I'm gonna stay on the couch. That's where my drink starts. I don't get struck drunk. And then I'm afraid to call my sponsor because she's asked me if I went to the medium. I tell her no. And then she mean to me. And which she wouldn't. She just tried to help me, you know. And then all of a sudden I'm depressed on the couch for 3 or 4 days, not answering my phone, not doing anything. And so I realized I had to keep my feet going. My sponsor told me, she said, Debbie, put legs on your prayers. You know, I always waited, sit around like I'm going to read this. I'm going to understand it. I'm going to go to the meetings and kind of do this. And then I was waiting to be poofed with the AA magic dust because I want happy and I want to take the shortcut version of that. Right. Yeah, yeah. So that didn't happen. But what happened is all of a sudden a year sober and I couldn't believe it. I was afraid to even tell anyone. And so anyway, I proceeded to, you know, I have been transformed. I'm not the same person. And there's a couple things I want to tell you for people that have really had struggles and think AA doesn't work. It works if you work it. Well, that's true, you know, but the honesty was a big piece for me. I really need to let, I don't have to go out and tell everybody my business. They probably don't want to hear it anyway, but I've got to be brutally honest with someone. And I have a group of women that are, we all just put it like, you can listen to what I said or did yesterday. Gabby and I were talking about it. You know, nobody's putting out, you know, we're striving to change and be helpful. But man, I've got a lot of bumps in the road. I can be just straight up. I've gotten a lot nicer though through the years. I really have. My husband wouldn't say that. But now we get along. We have he gets me and I get him. I'm like, shut up, you old fool. And, but we're honest with each other. And we've been through a lot through the years. I mean, so this is one of the things that really helped me. I had a whole new experience when I came through in 2006 with the book. I started seeing things differently. And one of the things that really helped me was, I remember when we agnostics, first of all, when I first came around, I don't need to read that. I love Jesus and God and everything. And that's about those agnostics. I'm not one of those. Well, I missed the whole thing. It's about my mind. And it is about challenging. You know, it has the word prejudice 7 times in there. Like everything you already think, you know, maybe you might want to set that aside for a little bit. Let something, you know, what society's told me, my family's told me, or what I think I know, I need to set that aside because the information I've been working with has not served me well. So also in the doctor's opinion, it talks about that restless, irritable discontent. So I kind of looked at that and I thought, well, let me just tell you, I thought that was me in active addiction, active alcoholism. That's me sober. That's what we treat here. That was a newsflash to me. You know, I realized like, that's why I keep drinking because I'm restless. I don't know, like a dog chasing my tail. I'm irritable. Like I'm judging. You're getting on my damn nerve. I call it having your ass up on your shoulder. You know, somebody, I said that, somebody came, so what's that mean? It's like, you're just a little touchy. And, you know, like somebody says, good morning. You're like, what do you mean by that? And I mean, I can be like that, you know, edgy. And then I'm discontented. I'm happy. I'm frustrated. It's come to this. The hopes, desires of my life and dreams aren't panning out. And then you add on, you know, panic, anxiety disorder, depression, you know, I mean, whatever, my God, no wonder I need a drink. And that restless, irritable discontent can show up, but I'm aware of it. And we have the wonderful tools that treat that, but I got to be patient and not beat myself up. I'm like, well, look how I'm showing up today and call and talk to somebody or call some newcomer like, oh God, I think I'll be nice. Look what he's dealing with. That used to be me. But also the other thing is, and because I think I got to end here, like in about how much do I have? A minute. Okay. We want people to get well, not sick. I keep talking. So you know, people, I'm just sharing my experience and what I've seen. A lot of people, and they either hate God, don't know God, don't have that, you know, like I got to find a power greater. I'm like, yeah, I know. It doesn't matter. You know, what happened to me? I was so, so broken when I came here in 2006. What it says in We Agnostics is there's a couple of different places, but it gave me hope. It says, if you now believe or are even willing to believe, there is a power and it doesn't say what it's got to be greater than yourself, then they emphatically assure you you're on your way. You know, that flimsy read, you know, something like slipping through my hand, man, I can't get it. But I strengthen that by the what my feet do, the actions I take, the honesty. So that gave me hope, because it's like, I don't believe in nothing, even AA. But I believe, I'm willing to believe, because I have evidence of it. Of these 10 years I've been in and out, people's lives are getting better. Mine's going down the drain. And all those negative promises in the book have come true in my life. So what happened, I proceeded to just live in the middle of the circle and the triangle in all three parts of AA. I am sponsored. I sponsor. I do, you know, everything I can do. My recovery comes first. My husband, I mean, it's number one. And as a result, I have a big life, a busy life, too busy sometimes, but God, you know, gives you what I'm always given the time I need to do what I need to do. And I don't center my life around AA. I center AA, and then my life falls into. And I learned that all here. And I'm very grateful. I have a wonderful group of people. I know people all over the world. And, you know, we've been very active. And, you know, I just want to say, Bob and I celebrate 30 years of marriage, and people are like, I need to write a book. I mean, there is no, we have been through it, and I trust and respect and love him so much. And I'm a big fan of AA, because the thing that I love the most in the entire world, I had to watch from the age of 15, being a member of AA and seeing what happens to most young people. And it was right in my home. I thought that, you know, he raised in AA and he saw how bad it was and he wouldn't drink. And he got sober at 18. And I just adore and love and adore my second son, Morgan. I'm just blessed. And I know there's so many more things I'd love to share, but that's what showed up. And so we'll just go with that. And the smokers can go smoke and people go to the bathroom. And I love all of you. And I'm just so, so grateful. I really, truly am, from the bottom of my heart. So God bless you. And thank you.
All right, the baskets are right here. We're going to pass the seven tradition basket around. We also have a PayPal and a Venmo account. The scan card should be in there. If not, see me after the meeting. The seven tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general services office remain self-support. This keeps AA free of outside influence that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who stays. Our common welfare, word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting. Announce.
First off, I want to say thank everybody for bringing food. We did have one where it was very slack on the food, so y'all really showed up, and I do appreciate that. I'm Morgan. I'm an alcoholic, and this is a vision for you. Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you. Oh, yeah. And don't forget to come thank our speaker at the end.
Thanks, Maureen. All right. So again, the tables can stay where they are at. The chairs go back, but let's make a big circle. And then afterwards, again, everyone will have the chance.